All right, so I'm really excited to introduce our next session. Robert Levine is our moderator today, author of Free Ride, a contributor to Billboard and other publications. And he's here with Benji Rogers. And Benji is the founder and chief strategy officer of Pledge Music. I think I'll just leave it at that and turn it over to Rob. So thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Before we begin, I wanted to comment on one other thing about the future, partly a very serious comment, also one I was dared to make. How many of you have seen the toilets downstairs? I just want to say, like, in our country, we're talking about, you know, who has the fastest internet. Our toilet technology is completely behind. It is a national embarrassment. And if you go downstairs, you'll see what I mean. On a more serious note,
I always have a toilet joke open for me wherever possible.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how that would go over, but you know, it's wake everybody up.
Like shit in a hole in the floor.
There you go. Hey, I don't work blue. Benji Rogers is the founder and chief strategy officer of Pledge Music, which is a really cool company. They've released 1,000 albums and other projects, 130 of them in the top 20, 55 employees. He's also founded something called the Dot Blockchain Music Project. We're going to be talking mostly about that and a little bit about Pledge. So first, tell me, how did you go from Pledge to Dot Blockchain Music Project, which is a very sort of, in some ways, a much more ambitious idea that could disrupt much more?
I think it's a willingness to experience as much pain as possible. So basically, in about October or September of last year, I started to kind of, I got bitten by what can only be described as the blockchain bug. And I had this thought that a blockchain database could be an extraordinary place to store digital truth, as it were. So basically create a state of digital permanence to say that a thing happened in time and space, and you could build on that as it moved. So I took out a provisional patent on a blockchain-anchored codec, which I thought would be a kind of a cool thing, and I worked with Alan Bargfried, a Berkeley lawyer, about this. And I sat with my wife one night, and I said, the problem is if I own this patent, or I could get this patent, which would be a tough one anyway, no one would use it because it's a private company. And for a global distributed database of rights to exist, it would need to be kind of pure. It would need to sit in and of itself. And what I really realized and I got obsessed by about the blockchain was is that its size and strength is its power. The number of people using it makes it stronger. And that's a really amazing thing that hadn't in my life existed. And I attended the first conference where we talked about the blockchain, and there was basically 8 people in the room. And one of those was Scott Cohen, who came up to me and said, this is what internet conferences were like when we took the internet to the music industry for the first time. Check it out. And Pledge really solved what I would call the first mile problem, which is that, you know, artists would basically go into debt, make things, and then sell them, and that had to work. But I was like, but all music is crowdfunded, really, so why not just let them buy in before it's made? So we dealt in the creation of these rights, which was a nice thing. And I believed that all I would do is present a whole bunch of data to the music industry and say, look, the average user wants to spend $55 per transaction. Let's do more of that. 7 years later, we're still explaining that to the music industry to say that there is these customers who want to pay more, and the music industry's answer was, let's send them all to a place where they can spend $9.99 a month on thousands of artists. So that was it. And basically what happened was is the last mile, I watched these artists come through our platform. We do, you know, 1,000 artists a year come through this, and they make these albums and they make money and they have a rich data set. And then the second that music gets kind of pushed into an MP3 or a wave, it just drops off a cliff. And it drops off a data cliff, it drops off a revenue cliff, it drops off, you know, all kinds of things. And it just occurred to me that if we as the music industry want to affect a change, we need to present our work in such a way that there is a proof that a certain thing happened at a certain time. It's you know, like I used to send tapes to myself, you know, of my own work with lyric sheets, you know, like that. And so what occurred to me was this, so I sat down with my wife and I said, I've had this idea for this patent which I've got, I'm gonna give it away. I'm gonna create this public benefit company to try and do it. And she said, you know, reluctantly, she said, cool, go for it. And I published the first blog in November of last year, basically showing anyone in this room how to build this architecture. And I updated it with an even more technical diagram about a few months later. And I gotta say, I've just received thousands, and I'm not exaggerating, thousands of emails saying, can we help? I've had lawyers emailing saying, can we help? I've had digital service providers, tech companies, labels, publishers, you name it, saying, can we help? Because it's kind of touched a nerve. It's a bit blockchain-y, right? And I'm very realistic about what blockchain can do and what it most importantly cannot do today.
But yeah. Let me cut you off for a second. Before we get into some of the technical stuff, tell me, what can this do?
So today, and for the last 8 years, the Bitcoin blockchain has published a new set of information every 10 minutes, or 10.23 minutes, whatever it is. And it's basically run by a network of thousands and thousands of computers all over the world processing little tiny transactions. And to overwhelm that network or alter anything is really difficult to do because you're not attacking one central system. You'd have to attack thousands of systems simultaneously, and that would invalidate the protocol. So something that a man, woman, or group of people named Satoshi Nakamoto created and gave to the world, essentially, is now about a $9.2, I think, billion-dollar market cap industry in spite of every other financial institution, despite all that tried to attack it endlessly and daily. What a fucking opportunity that is, right? Like, what has ever come about that way since then, you know? And it was discussed, you know, by people like Fred Wilson and D.A. Wallach and a bunch of people like kind of were kind of glomming onto the possibility that something was here, right? What it can't do is it's not, it's fallible, right? It's still, there's people running it. There's still interest trying to take it down. It's battle tested. Neha Narula from MIT Media Lab, she said it's production hardened. It spent 8 years of hackers trying to take it down, and it's still there. And it's transacting 100,000 transactions a day. It's not enough for the music industry. Music would be more than that. If we look at it from the point of view of its payment systems and tracking systems. But if you look at it as a registry, if you, you know, register 100,000 tracks a day or beyond that, I think it's really interesting. And I think that we can create an initial, what I call minimum viable data set or minimum proof, put it into a system, and if everyone feeds from the same trough, as it were, forgive the analogy, we can all know what's happening, and it broadcasts those changes every 10 minutes. And I believe that under the architecture we're proposing, and we're giving it as an open source system, the UI is open sourced, every piece of this can be reused and built upon, I think we can create a structure of ownership that has never existed before. And I demoed it last week at home, where I took something I owned, the musical and the copyright of, you know, the publishing and the performance, and I pushed it into a blockchain testnet. And I could play it back, and I could change ownership, assign it to somebody else in this test environment. So it's basically built. Now we've got to, you know, put the bells and whistles on. But and that took 6 weeks, and we invested $75,000 into it. And part of the reason that we went this approach was not saying, let's all sit around and agree how it's gonna work. It was, let's build it, and then we'll start to invite people in. And some interesting consequences of building it emerged, which, you know, become extremely interesting for the people in this room.
Can you give us a concrete example? So let's say we write a song together. Yep. A song about, let's say, I don't know, the future of toilets.
Yep. Yeah.
It's a hit already.
The remix is a hit, yeah.
The remix, well, exactly. The remix comes before the song nowadays. So how do we assert our rights, and how do other people get that information?
So the way that I approach this, and I as we now, we've got, you know, a team far smarter than I, and an amazing development team in CTO. The way that I approached it was, the moment it goes wrong really is when it leaves the studio, when it leaves the moment of creation. So you and I are in the studio.
That early.
I think so. So you're now in the studio, and if I said to you, we've just written this great toilet song, send me a copy of it. The second you go export as MP3, I can do whatever the fuck I want with it. I can do anything with it. I can assert any kind of right that I choose. And you can argue with me if you know where I'm asserting that right, and if you know where I'm basically pushing it. So if it's called Toilet Song Number One, and I retitle it as My Love of Japanese Toilets, and I basically call my publisher.
Everyone's
up.
Laughing. Have you guys looked at the pop charts?
Yeah.
It's not that far-fetched.
So I call my publisher up and I say, I've written a song called I Love Japanese Toilets. I own 80% of the copyright on it. And they say, great, let's put that with the PRO. So that goes in. So it's not called what you sent it to me. And so my publisher and my PRO have different information. Now you fax your publisher and say, I've written a song called
Toilet Number One. Make Me Flush.
Yeah.
It's like a love
song. So now we got two
different
things.
Yeah.
So you can see where it starts to go wrong. And then ultimately, multiple versions of this thing start to exist. Now, what if at the point that I say to you, send me a copy of the song, you say, okay. And when you go to export, you export it in what we call a .bc, which is basically a wrapper around the music files, which contains the metadata. And you have to say, I am a contributing writer to this. You don't have to assert the split just then, but you can just say, I'm a contributing writer. I'm a performer of this. This is what it's called, and this is its regions of availability. If you just had those four pieces of information, you take that, drop it into a system called the IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, in a signed encrypted bundle, and that stripes the blockchain with that moment. So the opportune in the blockchain, the string of information says, this happened at this time and place to this bundle here. Now, when you send me that bundle, I'm still accessing the MP3, but I'm also hierarchied into the data structure. So I get to sit there and say, right, this looks good to me, but I think we should retitle it.
And just to be clear, you're not talking about consumers. You're talking about
this is internal
wholesale.
Industry process. Yeah.
Right. Okay. This is a chain between wholesalers, if you will.
Yeah.
So the label to Spotify,
correct.
iTunes, Apple Music.
So what happens is the data is persistent from the moment of the demo to the moment it's mixed to the moment it's mastered on and on. So for example, the performer, we have a guitarist come in. He comes in, authorizes himself into the system, says, I'm part of the session now. That data of him is going to...
Chuck Berry's going to play
Chuck
on
Berry's
it. Sorry,
exactly.
I had
yeah.
to go there.
So
someone's old enough to get
so,
it.
So basically, it's basically predicated on the system that what we're sharing with each other is permission. And what we also carry... What traverses the chain with permission is obligation. So basically, you can digitally express your rights and intentions into the music at the point of creation. And therefore, wherever it goes from there, if it goes into multiple services, then they're going to be reading it as a there's this one central place that we know that that's kind of pushed in. If the data goes in wrong, so in this scenario, you're about to make a claim of something that is untrue. You're about to publicly broadcast.
The data is unalterable in the chain, but this is only, keeping that data, having a foolproof, tamper-proof way of keeping data intact is only valuable and useful if the original data is valuable and useful.
So, yes and no. This is the bit that occurred to me was, people will make statements of truth all over the place, right? Japanese have the best toilets in the world is a statement of truth we could make, right? And we're going to validate that. Who am I the authority on it, by the number of times I've been to the bathroom? Why are we going here? Anyway, I guess in one way of putting it is this. When you go to express your rights into that file, you will be saying, I, Robert, own a piece of this song. And that is something that becomes kind of hard-coded into the system. Because I can't delete that entry, I can, however, amend it forward. So when I get sent a copy of that file, or my publisher or my PRO picks up something that I've claimed a piece of, they can go, that was an original assertion of proof right here. And the hack that we have to kind of figure that out is, well, we're going to scan a match against existing songs. Like, what a novel thought. Why don't we do this all the time? Let's go check. So part of our UI is a Spotify lookup. So you can sit there and say, oh, this song sounds a lot like Beyonce because we checked up against Grace Note. Are you going to claim that you own Beyonce now? No. Is it a cover? Yes. Who wrote the song? I don't know. Who made it famous? Beyonce. Okay, we think it's this. Just using that so that you can't push anything into this system. If it's a new creation, you will assert that it's a new thing. But if it's an existing creation, you'll say it's a cover version of that song. And you don't have to identify the writer if you don't know them. You identify who made it famous, which then means you can track back to the writer on and on. So if you put 40% of the information incorrectly and the other 60% wrong, that's okay. Because if it's amended, the current version of truth is broadcast to everyone in the system every 10 minutes.
Now, let me ask, before we get to how this might work on a retail level, let's use as an example, you know, recordings are obviously easier to scan and match than written compositions.
Yep.
So let's say, you know, if you're putting a song up on, I don't know, one of the songs, one of the companies that let you put your songs up on iTunes, they let you put your songs
aggregator,
up.
Like right, TuneCore or CD Baby, yeah.
Right, so let's, TuneCore was the one I forgot the name. So let's say I put up a song on TuneCore, and TuneCore says you're responsible. You know, they don't like to say, hey, we're not going to aggregate this song if you're not paying the mechanical royalties on it. They said, have you, you know, do you assert that you own rights to everything? And they're assuming that the average garage band in America knows the difference between a recording and a composition, and they're not just going to check yes. They would have to adopt this, and you think they will, because it will be, it will save them.
Yeah. So
work.
So ultimately, the way I view this is that when TuneCore could be a point of creation for .bcs, the PRO, when you're registering your work, could be the point of creation for these things. The reason that we're building an open source project is so that every single player in the music industry can plug in. So the way it is the song and its, the recordings of the song and its data become like the base point, and every other party is a plug-in to it. The publisher is a plug-in, the co-writer is a plug-in, the background singer is a plug-in. The, you know, in the cases of, in the case of a remix, is this a remix? Yes. You know, of what songs or what song or songs, and you can list as many of those as you can. Then we're going to whack up against Dubset's database. So the purpose of this is to get as much of the truth as you can get in as possible, knowing that you're never going to get it perfect, as Courtney said earlier on very eloquently, but that you can amend it forward, never backwards. And the reason I think that that's key is, if I'm going to sit there and make an assertion with in front of all the people in the music industry that I want to work with, to say, I own this song by Beyoncé, that's a bold move to make, particularly because all of a sudden your reputation is going to suffer a hit if you're the one that's continuously claiming crap that you don't own. So the kind of hack to this is, A, you're scan and matching on the way in. B, you're identifying covers and derivatives on the way in. C, if SoundCloud, YouTube, Spotify, et cetera, become compliant in this form of technology, then you're actually, you know, making their lives a lot easier, because they get to sit there and say, this is the song, this is the point of proof for it. They don't need to, they can, you know, the owners of the work give permission for them to use it. So they can go in and say, I want the MP3, this is the current person that I pay based on the blockchain architecture, have at it, and it's amended forward. So if a change of ownership happens, then it's published to the entire network. Every PRO reads the same information. Every publisher, every record label, if you want to sync the song and license it, you get to know who those owners are. So it's a way of doing it, and it sounds improbable, but what's funny is I was in a studio, ironically, in Nashville with Deep Purple briefly, and I said to the engineer, show me how you export a song to send to the band at night. Just Pro Tools, export as MP3. And that was the moment. I was like, okay. So if I were to get hold of that guy's phone, I can basically make assertions on this left, right, and center, and nothing is going to stop me. A lot of labels now are, you know, making the Pro Tools login kind of, you know, they're owning that Pro Tools login, which is a smart move, right? If I'm paying for the session, I want the engineer to all fit in. Why not take that to its extreme, which is, any time you're going to go export something, just state whether you own it or not. If you're saying you own it, great. Now, if fingerprinting comes along, YouTube Content ID comes along later on and finds it and argues with you, great. If you fix it from one place, which is all places, the irony of it is you're fixing it in one central place that is all places, then we can have a logical argument over its outcome. But today, if any publishers in the room, by the way? No publishers. Okay. Well, if a publisher were to identify one of their works in a master recording that is being used on YouTube, how do they publish to every PRO globally, every other publisher, every label, every digital service provider instantaneously that this is the new ownership? How is that done? So, and those who receive said information are under no obligation to actually honor it, right? So if you're claiming that you own it in Sweden, right, and you can basically, you know, it's absurd. And then you've got multiple ISRCs assigned to the same song. So the point being that the perfect .bc bundle would have the high res, medium res, low res, stems, the ACC for Apple, because they like their special piece. You could have the lyrics, you could have the sheet music, you could have everyone who played on it, an ISRC, an ISWC, just for Bill Wilson and ISNI, and you could have all of those. That's the perfect file, right? And then you can start to enrich it with other data around it. Like, this is the tempo, the key, the lyrical content, on and on. This is where I like for it to be used. This is why no cat torture videos or, you know, hot dog porn, whatever it is that you want, you can't use it in these scenarios. Or I prefer
that you
not.
What if I started?
Yeah.
Well, this is actually...
In the gutter, there's only one place to go.
I know. Down. This is actually something that I'm interested in. You know, you get into this idea of you're expressing, on some level, what's most interesting to me about this, and there's obviously a lot of other things that are interesting. One of the most interesting things is you can express in that bundle your desire for what happens to that song, which is an incredibly powerful thing. I want people to be able to do this, but not that.
Yeah.
One of the things you run into is that not everybody in, I hate this word, but the music ecosystem, yeah, may necessarily respect that, because we already know that there are certain things you can do with certain files.
Yeah.
If you think back to the original version of iTunes, it had DRM, and it was like what you can do with this, what you can't. And a lot of people, some people objected to it, but also there was a sense that not everybody respected it. Like, so if you're uploading something on Spotify, Spotify might, this is just my opinion off the top of my head, might say, awesome, you saved us a lot of money building a database.
Yeah.
YouTube might say, hey, wait a minute, what's this gonna do to user-generated content? Because if you listen to what they sometimes say, part of your essential sort of freedom as a human being is to just upload the radio playing, talk over it, and, you know, that's sort of your expression of yourself. That's a little sarcasm for you. How do you deal with that? Because not everyone is necessarily going to respect your desires.
And I think that there's two things. Today, so I was a recording artist for years, and I made these recordings. And I would prefer that my recordings are not used in cat torture videos. And such a thing does exist, by the way. I read about it. It's awful. So, but where would I state that today? Where would I actually say, I don't want that to happen? There's nowhere, really. And what I think is fascinating is, it doesn't have to be respected by YouTube or by that person, but the interesting thing is if YouTube were to adopt a system like this, or SoundCloud, et cetera, and let's say I'm going to record an a cappella version of a song into my phone, because, you know, very clearly UGC is about that, right? I'm gonna sing into it, or there's a radio playing in the background. It will scan and match against it to see if it already exists. So the way I would view UGC, and this is just, I'm hypothesizing because someone's going to build this on top, would be to say, I sing my song in, and then it just asks me one question. Are you the creator of this? If yes, your authentication into YouTube is a point of authenticating, because you had to authenticate via email,
right,
which means that you're probably paying YouTube for some kind of other service. Similar
and
thing
just,
with
let me,
SoundCloud.
Let me cut you off for one second, because this is important. You know, YouTube, some of the stuff that's uploaded is anonymous. When you certify on blockchain that you own that, that is traceable to an entity, if not a human being. And the entity it's traceable to sort of resolves. Like, you can find out who asserted that at some point.
And the UGC part is definitely a difficult conundrum, and I wouldn't claim to have solved it all. But the way that I view it is, if you were to just say, is this a cover song? That would be a start, right? Just, is this a cover? Because it would, the audio fingerprint, it might pick it up as saying, well, this sounds an awful lot like Dexy's Midnight Runners to me. Is it? If you say, no, it's something I wrote, okay, you've made that statement. This is a new creation. You are the publisher and the author. If I come along and find out something, I can amend that forward after I've had a little battle with you. The question that really, what it puts to a UGC platform like YouTube or SoundCloud or others is, it says this: how does it disadvantage your business to know who owns this recording? How does ownership knowledge disadvantage you? And if a rights holder, whether it be Sony ATV, Universal, or my indie label, if we express our rights and intentions into the files themselves, and we can assign permission and obligation in exchange, we can state that. Is that legally binding? Not today, no. Can platforms become compliant in it and therefore honor the creator's wishes? Why not? How would it harm them to allow files that allow for digital rights expression into them? What's the downside? Well, could it be legislated against later on? Sure.
I mean, I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. I think you make a good point. How does it hurt some businesses? The mind reels. But it's a reasonable question to ask. I think it should be asked, loudly and often, for all sorts of reasons in all sorts of ways. One of the comparisons I wanted to make, and after this I'll open it up for questions if we have any time, is this sounds a bit like in some ways, like a highly sophisticated form of DRM. I know DRM is sort of the three-letter word that goes with the four-letter words, but if you think about DRM, it was a simple way of expressing permissions, except there was only really one permission: play it?
Yeah.
And the only answer was yes, no, and it normally, often the answer was no, because I'm not feeling, I'm broken. But, it wasn't terribly good or terribly effective, but this is, in some way, a stronger version of that. What you saw on the tech side was a total disdain for DRM, and you now have, people on the other side of the copyright debate sort of glorifying permissionless culture. Mm. Is that something you see as a problem for people adapting this? Because in some ways, it's a great it's a great idea, but it's a great idea that I think for it to work, it depends on some scale.
The hardest thing about this was I spoke at the BPI, the British Phonographic Institute in the UK, and that was like, but wait, this is DRM, and DRM to me was, I bought a Sunvolt CD from Tower Records and I couldn't put it on my iPod, and that was dumb, and I'm like, this is idiocy. So I take it back to Tower Records and say, give me one that works.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet what was interesting was as I was watching Deep Purple kind of go through this process of just basically giving away their work to whoever the stone guy in the studio was at that moment and being like, well, I'm sure it'll be fine, it occurred to me that you can begin a musical works creation with everything checked, have at it in every single conceivable usage. And, so it's automatically defaulted to be able to use on YouTube's UGC. It's defaulted to SoundCloud. You can remix it to within an inch of its life. But the cool part about that is that remix, which can contain 30 compositions, is persistent right the way through because the data is always attributable back to those who own it. So you're going to create this massive database of ownership. And the conundrum that you state is really interesting. And I had this thought, and we had it on our weekly call for the Dot Blockchain project, was... a publisher may upload a sound recording of a composition that they own 5% of to the system. And what that means is they might say, and Sony owns the sound recording. So Sony's got to go in and pay attention to that because a statement of truth has been made out there. So what I realized was we're going to push the boat out and we don't have a rope to pull it in. You can't email .blockchain and say you need to take that down. We don't have that. That's not how this works. We don't have the permission to take it down. You have to have your battle in one central place. So there are certain publishers and labels that have committed to giving us songs already, quite a substantial number of them. And part of the caveat...
Tell people what you mean by giving you songs.
So what they're going to do is they're going to basically become plugins to this system. So they'll say, I own these 30 songs. I own the publishing to these 30 songs. The label's over here. So they're going to push it into the system, and it will notify the label, hey... your songs are now in this system. The label comes in and claims the ownership piece, right? The plug-in to that. So each, remember I said the song's here and each kind of party to it is a plug-in on top, and that creates these blockchain IDs. So statements of fact will be created into an existing ecosystem the second the first one goes in. And that was a deliberate strategy because we would talk about the various ways of putting music into the system for years and never get it done. This will exist in the next few weeks, and people will start to make statements of it, and it will grow from there. There will be battles, I'm sure, but the main reason that I'm doing this and that the team are doing this is we made a very clear decision. Is this to make money and create a private company? No. Is this to create something that will change and alter the rights landscape for years to come if we get it right? And I must state just before we go to questions that the Bitcoin blockchain is a temporary solution that we're using. This is actually blockchain agnostic. It can go to any type of system. But to my mind and to the architects of this system's mind, the larger and more distributed the system is, the safer it is. Therefore, the Bitcoin blockchain is, again, production-hardened. We're not trying to boil the ocean and do micropayments, and you know, this isn't an interface layer with humans, with the public. But what it is it's going to create hierarchies of ownership that are changeable forward but never backwards. Family trees of ownership will emerge, and my hope is that private companies will build massively on top of this architecture so that if you've got a better blockchain than the Bitcoin blockchain, fantastic. You know, great, we can push into that as well. It's not subservient to a single Bitcoin or blockchain technology, but what it is it's the expression of digital rights into a format that is anchored in a persistent way. And you know, Bill Wilson was a big help in kind of architecting the data side of this because we need to understand. You know, I'm a singer-songwriter. I wrote songs for years, and I would go to ASCAP and say, I wrote this, and I write it on a piece of paper. I don't know where that goes. I don't know what my ASCAP number is. I just don't know. How does it relate back to the actual recording that I put in an envelope and mailed to myself? Like, the two don't meet. But we can with a blockchain, as long as the system and electricity works and distribution remains wide, create digital permanence. And we can alter forward as changes are made, but if we get that bundling piece right and it sits in this system that people can access, we create the digital library of Alexandria every time a song is created. And the beautiful part is the music industry, rather than say, you guys play by our rules or you guys create a database so that, you know, solve our problem, we say, as an industry, this is how we express our rights digitally. This is how we do it. If you alter those, or if you choose to traffic in files that are not in this way of doing things, you're going against our wishes. I won't be the one to make the call on whether that becomes legally binding. It's not the purpose of this. But the purpose is to basically start it, and it begins when the Genesis file kind of goes in this way, which hopefully will be next week. So.
All right, I'm going to have to stop you guys. And we've gone over time.
Oops.
Are you going to be able to hang out for a little bit, though? Because I think what we should do is get the next session going so we don't miss lunch and, you know, kind of get off schedule. And we have a really interesting transition right now because we've been talking a lot about music, but this next session on the RiceTech technology stack has a lot of non-music people on it. So I think it's going to be interesting dynamic. And Ed, if you could come up, and round of applause for these guys.
Thank you.
Session. And we'll get started right away here so we stay on schedule, okay?